yena bhagavatadamo sapatipanno yasa bhagavato savakasango tamayang bhagavantang sadamang sasangang ime hi sakare piyatarahang aropitehi abipujayama sadhuno bhante bhagava suchira parinibhutopi pachimajanata nukampamanasa ime sakare dugata panakara bhute patiganhatu amha kang digharatang itaya sukaya arahang sama sambuddho bhagava buddhang bhagavantang abhivademi svakato bhagavata dhammo dhammang namasami supatipanno bhagavato savakasangho sanghang namami. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Iti piso bhagava arahang sammasambuddho vijacharanasampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisadhammasarati sata deva manusana buddho bhagava tamahang bhagavantang abhipujayami tamahang bhagavantang siddhasanamami. Svakato bhagavata dhammo sanditiko akaliko ehipasiko oppanayiko pacchatang veditambo vinyuhi tamahang dhamma abhipujayami tamahang dhamma siddhasanamami. Supatipanno bhagavato savakasangho ujjupatipanno bhagavato savakasangho nyayapatipanno bhagavato savakasangho samicchipatipanno bhagavato savakasangho yadidang chattari purisayugani atta purisapugala
The Adam Brahm cult, is that right? Adam Brahm cult in action. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's how you know. It's Adam Brahm's impact on the world. Yeah.
answer.
Yeah.
Only the first two lines are all. The great or the mighty. But later on became
and. Yeah. Yeah, maybe because because is that in the Pali? Did you look at the Pali?
Is it
Va all the way here? Really here?
Oh,
okay, that's a bad translation. Is that what he's saying?
So oh, only yeah. The first two lines he put all. Then after that is and near and far instead of near or far.
Great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the other one is and. Ah, okay. There's a few chars and a few vas down here. It depends. What happens in Pali is that it depends on the meter, because this is verse.
Yeah.
So in verse you have meter, and va and cha is a different quantity. Va is long,
but
cha is shorter.
I think
yeah.
Va is all, right?
Yeah, but in the Pali you have both. If you look at the Pali, has both. You see, here. There's a mixture. There's a mixture in the Pali here. And this is why, I think this is why there's a mixture. So here you have cha, dita va ye cha adita, and here you have cha,
and here you have
va. So I don't think it means very much, because I think it is metrical reasons why it's va and cha, not because it actually means anything here. Yeah. So whoever wrote this, they had to write according to a certain meter, a certain rhythm. So they just added va and cha randomly according to the meter here. That's what I reckon. So there you are. So we could choose, we could do whatever we wanted, basically, yeah. But I think it should be and, shouldn't it? How can it be or?
Near or far?
Yeah, we should have meta for both, yeah, not one or the other, yeah. For both, near and far, yeah.
Then the great...
Otherwise you can choose.
But if you are near, you can't be far at the same time.
Yeah, we should have meta for both.
Meta for both.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, whatever. Yeah. I think we get the point. Yeah, we get the idea. Okay, these are the refined aspects of translation of the Metta Sutta. Okay, are you ready here?
Yes.
Everyone ready here? Yeah? Okay, good. Okay, so we can start. Is it this side or this side? This side is more interesting. Adventure Park map. There's a dragon there, there's all kind of stuff. Okay, let's get serious. Okay, are any of these questions from yesterday, Eileen, or are they all from today here?
All
from today. Okay, great. So it's from me, not Rajan Brahm. Okay, it's good to know. Sometimes it's Rajan Brahm and I have to clear all his questions. Okay.
Until 10 o'clock.
10 o'clock, really, yeah. He really goes for it. Kadir Ajahn, should we use willpower in meditation? Two, could you suggest any books for beginners about suttas? Thank you. Should you use willpower in meditation practice? The answer is I have to be careful what I say, because Ajahn Brahm is going to tell me off if I say the wrong thing here. But usually the biggest problem in meditation practice is not too little willpower. The biggest problem is usually too much willpower. And the reason is because we're so used to doing everything in the world with willpower. You're going to write a report, you have to do some assignment, or you have to get something done. And almost always you use willpower to get things done. So we have a habit of using willpower. And when it comes to meditation practice, we carry that habit with us. And because we carry it with us, you tend to do too much. So for that reason, it is better to try to avoid the willpower, because it's almost 99% of people use too much willpower in the meditation practice. But I think there is always, it's very hard to do anything without any kind of willpower, except if you are in a jhana state perhaps. So there's always, just by the very fact that you are trying to focus on the breath or whatever, there's always going to be a subtle willpower there. Yeah, and so you have to use, even just sitting down on the seat, even just directing your mind to your meditation object is going to involve some degree of willpower. Let's say that some angry thought arises. Yeah, you want to turn your mind away from the angry thought. It happens even in meditation, right? Sometimes something comes back to you. You know what I mean? It's terrible, but it happens even in meditation practice. So you turn your mind away from that angry thought. You think something about metta. You remind yourself to forgive the person. They don't know what they're doing or whatever it is that you do. And you move away from that. Just that wisdom aspect, just remembering the right thing to do, takes a little bit of will. Yeah, otherwise, you can't do anything without any kind of will. So
this is, so there's always some room for the will, but usually the majority of people overdo it, and that is the problem. And the point is also that as your meditation becomes more deep, as you become more peaceful, you have to reduce the will as you become more peaceful. And in a sense, it happens naturally, because as the peace starts to happen, you have less troubling thoughts, you have less desires, or less thing that comes in the way. So it's almost automatic that you reduce the willpower, because you don't need to control things anymore. There's nothing to do. It's just to relax and enjoy and sit back. And the deeper the meditation comes, if you start to get some joy in your meditation, at that point it becomes very easy, because it is very natural to watch the breath at that particular point. But usually the reason why it is hard to watch the breath, usually why people want to use willpower, is basically because the mind may not be ready to watch the breath. This is basically the main problem. So if there are defilements in the mind, you have to use willpower to stay with the breath. The problem isn't that you can't stay with the breath. The problem is the defilement that stops you from being able to watch the breath. So you should really ask yourself, what is the problem? Why can't I stay with the breath? Why do I have to use willpower? And once you understand why, what the problem is, you can try to turn your mind in a different direction. But don't be, find that middle way. Find that kind of, that where you at least feel comfortable, you feel at ease. Too much willpower means that you often get tense, you can't relax properly. And we have, there's usually enough tension in this world already. People can't relax. Society is being very busy and people getting stressed out. So don't make meditation into something stressful. Because if you do, you are destroying this beautiful, wonderful path of Buddhism, which promises so much, but often we go wrong, and then we don't get the promises of this path. So try to kind of head in the right direction. Okay. Any books for beginners about the suttas? I would just recommend you to start reading the suttas. One of the best books is one book is called In the Buddha's Words. It is a compilation of suttas. It is a compilation done by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is one of the most famous translators. And he translates, first of all, his translations are very reliable. He's a very good scholar. Sometimes his language is a bit highfalutin because he has a PhD in philosophy. That's always the drawback with kind of having this kind of background, is that your language becomes a bit sort of hard to understand sometimes. But he's very good. He knows his Pali very well. He writes beautiful English. He has very good understanding of the Dhamma and all these kind of things. And in that book, it's an anthology, so it's a compilation of suttas from different places. They are put into categories. They are explained. There's notes, there is introductions, all these kind of things. It's a great place to start. Once you've started with that, you can start, once you have read that book, you can move on to like the Majjhima Nikaya, middle-length sayings of the Buddha. Middle-length sayings are beautiful. They are full suttas. You get a full kind of instruction by the Buddha. It has a bit of background material. Sometimes a bit of life of the Buddha is in there. The Buddha was staying in such a place. He was talking to people like this. You have a bit of a conversation going on. You get a bit of feeling for the Buddha as a person at the same time, which is very, very nice. And a lot of the Buddha giving his autobiography, talking about how he practiced before his awakening and all of this. And all of that is very inspiring and very interesting. The first one is called In the Buddha's Words. And the second one was the middle-length sayings of the Buddha, the Majjhima Nikaya. Okay. Bring it here. Okay. And then, of course, the question is, which translation to read? There's so many different translations. You have Ajahn Brahm's translations, that you've been seeing now. They're kind of interesting, He kind of has his own take on things, which is very interesting. You have Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, which are traditionally considered very authoritative and very good. They're very solid. But the most kind of modern translations are Bhante Sujato's translations that you find online. If you go to a website called suttacentral.net, you find all the suttas there, the Pali suttas translated into English. Yeah, you go to the Majjhima Nikaya, you can start with Sutta 1, or you can, actually don't start with 1, forget about that one. The 1 is too hard. Start with Sutta number 2, yeah? And then kind of move ahead. Because number 1 is about, listen, about one of the hardest suttas in the entire Tipitaka, so forget that one. And then to start reading, and his language is very easy, yeah, it's very quite natural. I was just reading a passage, one of his translations yesterday, and it was very, very beautifully the way he had put it together, I think, yeah. And his idea was that a lot of people these days, they have English as a second language. Yeah, most of us here, we all, pretty much all of us have English as a second, maybe some of you have as a first language, but many here have English as a kind of second language. And it makes it, you want to have a language which is fairly simple, not too high, not too technical, not, you know, not too, kind of, you had to have a dictionary there to be able to read it, yeah, Oxford English Dictionary, not the small one, the big one, to be able to, to be able to read these things, and that makes it so hard. And he is also very reliable, he's a very good scholar, he understands Pali well, he also does a bit of comparative research with, you know, the agamas that you find in ancient Chinese language, especially him. That makes it more interesting when you have a bit of comparative study as well. So start with that. And I would also recommend you to listen to some of the sutta readings. Yeah, you may have noticed that we do a lot of sutta readings that are available on the BSWA website. Yeah, I mean, some of you have probably seen those. And they are really, I really recommend those because Ajahn Brahm has a very good understanding of the suttas. I think that I have a pretty good understanding as well. So you can listen to my sutta readings if you like. And there's lots of good stuff there which is available. And we have just been doing the Mahapanibbana Sutta over the last couple of years. That's what I've been doing. It takes a long time to go through it. A lot of interesting material, and it will give you a good introduction, a solid introduction to how to read these things. So I would recommend listening to those things as well. Also, be independent as well. Just read your own, so you get a bit of independence. Try a bit of both. And I would also recommend you to read some of the inspirational things in Buddhist literature, like verse. There's a lot of beautiful verse in Buddhism. Dhammapada is very nice. Adasudato has recently been translated in Dhammapada. I think it is pretty much finished now. That's also available on Sutta Central. You have things like the Terigata and the Teragata. The Terigata is the verse of the ancient Arahant nuns from the time of the Buddha. Teragata, the Arahant monks. And these are also available on Sutta Central. And it's very inspiring. Sometimes one of the problems of being a woman in Buddhism is that there isn't that many role models for women. Yeah, of course, you can have be inspired by monks, it's not that. But it's nice to have women as well, who as role models. And if you read some of these ancient suttas, the Terigata, you find some very powerful role models right there. There's always lots of women on meditation retreats, lots of women who take the spiritual life seriously. So it's very nice to have that access to some of those ancient voices of women arahants from the time of the Buddha. There's also one of the other collections that is very nice that I would recommend you to look at is the in the Sangyutta Nikaya, the Connected Discourses of the Buddha. The first book is called the Saggata Vagga. Saggata means verse in Pali. Sa means with. So this is a book of suttas with verse. And lots of beautiful verse in there, the verses of the devas, when the devas come and talk to the Buddha, and how the Buddha responds to the devas. There are beautiful conversations between the king Pasenadeha, and the Buddha. They're actually very sweet, some of those suttas. There's all kind of suttas about the Buddha talking to Sakka, the king of the gods, and all kind of things. But one of the nice collections in there is the what is called the Bhikkhuni Sanyutta. And these are suttas spoken by bhikkhunis, and especially the bhikkhunis in the meeting with Mara and how they kind of defeat Mara in their practice. That's also quite inspiring and nice. So start with that, yeah? I should keep you going for a year, so next year you can come back and you can ask me again next year. Okay. Let's go to the next one. Okay, must the law of dependent origination, Pratitasamapada, be understood in the process that is linked to three lifetimes, past, present, and future life? Must it be understood? Well, let's put it this way. The way the Buddha taught it was in terms of three lifetimes. Of course, just because the Buddha taught it that way doesn't necessarily mean that it must be understood that way, because those people always develop things and they change things. But if you want the Buddha's teachings, which presumably is what you want, then the three lifetime is pretty obvious. At least to me, it's very obvious. Why is it obvious? Because you look at some of the links in dependent origination. The link number 11 is called jati. Jati means birth. It means Siddhartha translated it as a rebirth, which I think is actually a very good point, because every instance of birth is also an instance of rebirth. So you might as well call it rebirth. And how is that defined? Well, it is defined as the coming into existence of the five khandhas, the kind of the being born. It's very obvious that what is meant there is actually birth, coming into existence. It is not meant as some mental state arising, which is the metaphorical idea of birth that is sometimes being suggested by certain people. There are certain developments in certain parts of the later teachings, but they kind of move a little bit more towards this kind of idea. But in the suttas, it is very obvious that to me, I can't see how we can interpret differently, that it means three lifetimes, and it refers to rebirth is a very important part of dependent origination. Remember, the point about dependent origination is to show you how suffering arises. How does suffering arise? And suffering is the problem. It is a problem precisely because we carry on in samsara. That's why it's problematic. If you had died and then that would have been it, and it kind of finished and a normal problem afterwards, it wouldn't have been so much an issue. It is an issue precisely because of the issue of rebirth. So suffering and rebirth are almost like two sides of the... They're very closely related to each other. In fact, there is a sutta where... I think it's Venerable Sariputta, he says that rebirth is suffering. No rebirth is no suffering. So if you want to talk about suffering, you have to factor rebirth into the equation. Otherwise, you can't really talk about it. And dependent origination is precisely about how suffering comes about, how it comes into existence. So the answer, from my point of view, is absolutely yes. That is what the Buddha is talking about. In fact, the insight that you have once you start to get deep insights into your practice and once you become a stream mentor, for example, the insight of a stream mentor is precisely the insight of how craving gives rise to rebirth. Why, when you crave, it has to carry on. It can't stop. When you die, there's a force there. There's a force that propels you forward. And consciousness, the mind, everything cannot stop as long as that force is still there and still pushing you forward. So this is the insight of the stream mentor. You don't have to remember your past life to be a stream mentor, but you have to have this insight into the core, the essence of dependent origination. The essence of dependent origination is the link between tanha and jati. How tanha, craving, gives rise to rebirth in the future. That is how it gives rise to suffering. Okay. Okay. Is it because the mother carries the child for 10 months? 10 months. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah. That her love for her child is much more profound and unconditional. I suppose that's part of it. You get a very kind of, I guess, intimate relationship with your child because you carry it around for 9 months. It becomes very close. So that's probably part of it. So that's probably one reason, maybe why mothers often have a closer relationship to a child than a father has. Quite likely. But I think more so that's true. But I think the message in the Metta Sutta, which is so important, is the idea of how we can think like a mother. Yeah, some of you are obviously mothers already. You know what it's. You have some idea what it's like. And the idea is to kind of expand that idea of being a mother to all beings. And this is kind of the beautiful part of this. So what is it about being a mother? And one of the things, you know, is that a mother will tend to forgive her children. Yeah, even if the child does something stupid, in the end, you will still love your child, even if the child does something really bad or does something terrible. I know my mother forgave me. Yeah, even becoming a monk, she forgave me. That's pretty amazing. It's pretty astonishing. In fact, I think my parents, actually, after a while, they became very happy that I'm a Buddhist monk. I'm very, very pleased with that. That's a very, very positive thing. But of course, you have all the problems when you grow up. You're always arguing with your parents. And we've all been through those phases, and I've been there myself. And you know the power of the parents' love, how they always will forgive you and always let go of things. Why is it that a mother can do that? And I think part of it is because a mother, as you say, had to carry the child around for 9 months. Also, you have seen your child from it was tiny, tiny, yeah, very dependent on you, and when they're very sweet and very cute when they're young, not so cute when they become teenagers, perhaps, but starting off very cute. And because you see that, you know all the other sides of your child. You know that the child has more than just the teenage rebellion in them. They also have the sweet side, the cute side. It's also there, although it may be deeper down. May not be immediately visible once they come to 15 or 16. Yeah, maybe more hard to see. So because the mother knows that, the mother is always able to see the positive side in their child. Always remember the positive side. And this is what we should really remember. Remember that with most people around us, they too have a mother. That mother would have been able to forgive them. So if that mother was able to forgive them, surely we can also forgive that person in the same way. Everybody has a good side that a mother can see. Everybody has something there which is worthy of respect, worthy of love, worthy of forgiveness, worthy of compassion. And just remembering that is actually very beautiful. And then you don't judge people so harshly. So this is about reflecting in the right way, thinking in the right way, the power of reflection. Use that reflection wisely, and that is how you overcome the defilements of the mind and you purify the three kinds of right conduct. Okay. Dear Ajahn, how do you reduce the five hindrances in order to achieve good meditation? Yes, that that is a big topic. But there's many things to keep in mind. One of the things to keep in mind is that you should always focus on the biggest problems first. So whatever is your biggest problems in your life, focus on that first. The Buddha has a nice sutta where he talks about the refinement of gold, how gold is refined. And the way to refine gold, the gold here is a simile for the mind, because the mind is like gold. Beautiful simile, yeah. The mind is incredibly valuable because the mind has the potential to give you enormous happiness if you refine it in the right way. Just like gold needs to be refined to be beautiful and shiny, in the same way the mind needs to be refined to be able to be beautiful and powerful and give you all that happiness. So first of all, you have to know, do things stepwise. Don't start, sometimes people start off in the wrong way. They sit down to meditate, they have never done an act of charity in their life, never said a word of kindness in their life, and they sit down, they want to meditate. Oh yeah, watch their breath. It's impossible. You can't do it. You're starting in the wrong place. You have to start with the sila. You have to start with the kindness. You have to start with talking, saying nice things to people. Oh, what a wonderful thing to be here on this retreat with all of you, my fellows from Singapore and Hong Kong and Portugal / Norway, whatever it is. And what a wonderful thing it is to be here with so many good people. Yeah, and see the good qualities in the people around you and tell them what a wonderful privilege it is to be in the company of people like this. Because it's rare to have company like this in the world. It is not that common. So start with that. I know many of you are very good people. I've known you for years and years, many of you. I know that you're very good people. But sometimes people come in straight off the street, sit down to meditate without doing anything of these preliminary things, first of all. So ensure that your sila, your basic sila, is very powerful. Then the intermediate sila is the second thing to do. Yeah, intermediate sila is doing something with your mind, overcoming the anger, developing more metta and karuna and these kind of things. And then you develop your more refined sila. And when you come to the refined sila, that is really where we talk about the five hindrances. All the preliminary stuff is not really the five hindrances yet. The five hindrances have to do with meditation practice. All of this other stuff is the things that you do in your daily life, overcoming anger, overcoming irritation, overcoming kind of, you know, too much greed and all of these kind of things. And as you overcome that in your daily life, it enables you to come here to Jhana Grove and really chill and really enjoy here. Yeah, that's when meditation becomes nice, when you can really relax and really enjoy what's going on. This is how you gradually overcome these defilements of the mind. This is the first thing. Remember the sequence. Remember to start with the coarser things first of all. The second thing to remember is that the most important of these five hindrances are the first two. Yeah, the first two are kama chanda, desire. Second one is ill will, vyapada. These are by far the most important ones. And they are important because the other three hindrances, especially sloth and torpor and restlessness, is in large part, it comes because of the first two hindrances. So anger, of course it makes you restless. You're going to think about the person who upset you. You're going to get tired after a while, so you have sloth and torpor. Desire, of course desire is going to make you restless, because desire is some goal you want to achieve. It's somewhere you want to be. Don't want to be here, you want to be somewhere else. That's what desire is about, finding something more. So both of those things, by definition, are states of restlessness, of agitation. And eventually, they lead you to tiredness, because they tire out the mind when you think too much, and you desire too much, and you have ill will, and all of these kind of things. So this is what you do. So this is the beginning. Yeah. How do we overcome ill will? Overcoming ill will is talked about in one of my favorite suttas, because it is a very practical sutta, and I would recommend you to read this one if you are inspired by these kind of things. This is in the numerical discourses, the Anguttara Nikaya, the fives. Yeah, the Anguttara Nikaya is divided into different chapters, 1 to 11. This is the fives, number 163. It's called the Agata Pativinaya Sutta, which means the kind of the abolishing of agata, which is like ill will or resentment. And this sutta is all about how to overcome ill will. Incredibly practical. And this you can use in your daily life. You can also use it on meditation retreat, even in your meditation practice. So how do we overcome ill will? Well, the first thing to notice about ill will, it tends to be about other people. Yeah, that is the biggest problem. People are the biggest joy in the world. They're also the biggest problem in the world. Yeah, it's kind of this duality, hard to kind of somehow make this kind of mash up properly. But so it's about people. So how do we think about people? And first thing to do, as I said before, is to remember the good points in people. When you come here to Jhana Grove and you hang out with a group of meditators like this, please take time to just reflect on your good fortune, to be with people like this. Yeah, not perfect. They're going to make mistakes. They're going to irritate you every now and again by being insensitive or whatever. But the big picture is good. Yeah, the big picture is very, very beautiful. And when you think like that, you will abolish the little irritations, the little ill will so fast, because you remember the big picture. So this is always the most important thing, because this is actually what metta practice is all about. Metta is about focusing, shifting your focus to remembering the good qualities in the people around you. If all you see is the good qualities, that is almost like the definition of metta. Yeah, so when you do metta practice, you start off with the easy person, or you just think about a certain direction and you just remember the good qualities of people. And then from that comes this appreciation. Yeah, wow. What a wonderful thing. And then you get a sense of gladness because of that, because of the appreciation of other people. And that feeling, the warm feeling of metta arises from that. So this is the first thing. Shift your focus away from those negative qualities. Build up the perception of good qualities in people around you. People keeping precepts. People coming on meditation retreats. People holding teddy bears. Wow, that's very cute. So many people holding teddy bears. Isn't that nice? This is one of our specialities in this meditation center, teddy bear meditation center. So you remember that, and what a marvelous thing that we have such a tendency as human beings to focus on the negative, to have the fault-finding mind. It's everywhere in the world. Wherever you go, people have this tendency. So we need to train ourselves to focus differently, remember the good things. And when you build that up, the more you build it up, the more ability you will have to go there in the future when you need to overcome your negative thoughts or whatever it is. Yes, you build that up. Wow, yeah, what a marvelous thing it is to be with people like this. So this is the first thing. Another thing that you should do, sometimes it can be there are certain people it is difficult not to be fault-finding about. There are some people you may find it very difficult to see any good points in. So what do you do if you can't see any good points in somebody? You have compassion for them. Because someone who doesn't have any good points, they are in deep trouble. Yeah, if someone is a real scallywag, doing dodgy things, yeah, being very naughty, doing bad things, saying bad things to other people, not behaving well. They are in deep trouble. They are on the path to suffering. They're probably suffering really badly already. And if they're not suffering already, they certainly will very soon, whether in this life or in the future life. They're making bad karma, doing all kinds of bad things. So what you do here, very often, the reason why we allow other people to upset us is because we take it personally. Yeah, they're doing bad things towards me. They can't do bad things towards me. Actually, they can, but they shouldn't, or whatever it is. So we take it personally. But remember, it is not personal. When people do something bad, something stupid, it's not because of you. They do it because of their own inner conditions. They are compelled to do something stupid. They are compelled by these forces inside of you that you can't really control. They compel you. They make you act out stupid and silly things. Yeah, when you think like that, you start to feel sorry for the person. They can't stop themselves. They are being bad because of conditions from the past, because of how they grew up, because of things they experienced in a past life. Whatever it is, that is what is making them react in this way. I always like to say people are more like robots in a sense. They are programmed, there's a program inside of you that is very deeply embedded in your psychology. And this program makes you act in a certain way that very often you can't control. And if you think about yourself, you know, it's true. Very often you allow yourself to get irritated in the same situation again and again and again. Yeah, because it becomes a habit and you can't stop yourself. And this is so much part of the problem, not just for you, but for everyone. And if you learn to forgive other people in this way, you can also forgive yourself for your own bad habits. It is hard to change. Yeah, sometimes we think we should be able to change. Actually, it is very difficult to change. So if you can't change, forgive yourself, because it is hard. Yeah, it is not something you try again. Okay, I failed. Of course I failed, because it is to be expected I should fail, because these things are hard. So you try again. And you try again, and eventually you get there because you try again. Never judge yourself for your failures. Your failures are kind of baked into the equation, and you can't really avoid them very often. In this way, you have more compassion in the world, more compassion for yourself, more compassion for others, more patience, more time, more understanding. Everyone is suffering. Everyone has a hard time in this world, and when you kind of get that, it becomes easier. This is by far the most important thing to overcome, is ill will. And you can use these kind of reflections in your meditation. If you find some kind of ill will arising, just stop a little bit and remind yourself of this. And then you can kind of carry on again if it becomes something bad. Or sometimes you may just have to get up. That's okay as well if you have to get up. So this is the most important thing. About the other hindrance, the karma chanda, the desire, what you need there is you need more like an outlook on the world, seeing the world, thinking about the world in the right way. I didn't really have enough time to talk about this afternoon because times usually go so fast. But the idea is to have an outlook that makes the world less interesting. Yeah, the outlook of the Buddha is one where the world is not all that interesting. Why? Because the world is out of control. It's never going to give you what you want anyway. Yeah, in Hong Kong, nobody wants these demonstrations, but you got them. Yeah, we can't get out of it. You can't have it differently. And the world is always going to be like that. when you say the world is out of control, that's exactly what you mean, what is happening in Hong Kong now. When you say the world is out of control, it's the wars in the Middle East. When you say the world is out of control, it's the Brexit they're going through in the UK. It is kind of getting Donald Trump as your president. Yeah. I hope you don't, if you are a Donald Trump supporter, I apologize. I don't mean to say bad things about anyone, really. I'm just kind of, sometimes people get upset about these things. That's why these are just examples, yeah? Not really meant to be political statements at all. So, but this is the world. It is like this. And because we are used to having goals, we want things to work out, we want to get somewhere, it is always uncertain. You never know where those goals are going to be achieved. And that is why people get angry when things happen the way it happened in Hong Kong. They get angry because they think it's unfair. It shouldn't be like this. It should be like this. That's the point. This is the way it is. It has to be like this. And once you get that, what happens is that you lose a little bit of interest in that world, because it is not going to go according to a certain schedule or a certain outlook or a certain result that you want to achieve. The reason we are interested in the world is because we think that certain results will arise. If we know that those results are inherently uncertain, then of course the world is much less interesting. So this is how you overcome desire gradually. Yeah, understanding that the world isn't that interesting. Relationships aren't that interesting either, for exactly the same reason. Because relationships are so uncertain. All relationships end in tears. Is that right? It's true, isn't it? Because either a relationship is really bad. Lots of people have really bad relationships. And some of the monks we have in the monastery, they are monks because of bad relationships. And probably the same thing is true for the nuns as well. They're probably nuns because of bad relationships. And sometimes you get a few people, a tiny minority, they have a really, really good relationship, a very nice marriage, and it's really working out well. Well, they suffer when they have to die eventually. Yeah. When your partner gets cancer and you have you had an incredibly good relationship, very, very useful, you've been so close together, and then someone has to die. Yeah. So it is always problematic, regardless of what happens. So this is the way to reflect. Don't reflect too much like this, because you might get really depressed. And you come back and you can complain, oh, these monks, they are just really, they're terrible. They just make you depressed and sad. The idea, go slowly, go carefully. Yeah, use it in a wise way to help you to become peaceful. Take away some of the interest in the world. When that interest goes down, actually you become peaceful. You have less desires. Your values are changed. Instead of valuing the worldly things that are so unreliable, you value the spiritual life instead. And the spiritual life happens in meditation practice. It happens in kindness. It happens in generosity. It happens in wisdom. It happens with all these beautiful qualities. That's where it happens. And then you start to become peaceful. This is quite hard to do, because the world tends to go in exactly the opposite direction. So these things, you have to kind of continuously brainwash yourself. Yeah, gradually, gradually brainwash yourself. Clear out all the junk and put in some nice, clean, sparkling stuff instead. The sparkling mind comes out after a good brainwashing. Yeah. Don't not too literally. Yeah, don't kind of try to scrub your mind, but see what happens. So this is in short how you deal with the five hindrances. If you want a long version, please come on my next retreat. Okay. Neil adds that if someone does an activity out of obligation, and resentful feelings, however the activity is leading to good results, such as the caring activity done for others, is the intention based upon the physical activity performed, the result of the physical activity, or the unfriendly, resentful, harsh feelings associated while carrying it out, the activity? Well, this is this is what I call gray karma. Yeah, we often talk about karma either being good or bad, but the reality is that a lot of karma is kind of gray. It's neither good nor bad. It's somewhere in between. And this is a good example of that. You're doing something good, but you're doing it not with a kind of the right attitude. The attitude is a bit off, but the activity is still good. It's still positive. So you're probably heading in the right direction. Yeah. Eventually you may overcome that resentment. You may do it from a purer motivation. But initially you are creating more like gray karma. It's neither bad nor good. It's somewhere in between. So the trick in this kind of situation is to learn to have a different attitude. Yeah, if you have an obligation towards your old parents, for example, to look after them, and I think we all have that obligation. Yeah, I certainly feel that obligation myself, even though as a monk I can't do that much. I try to do a little bit to support my mother, who's kind of more alone now after the death of my father and all of that. So you do it, and you try to think about it in a different way. You try to create a positive attitude. Yeah, you remind yourself of what your parents have done for you, even if they weren't the best parents in the world. Every parent makes mistakes. Yeah? Every parent sometimes does the wrong thing. Yeah? But we forgive that, and you remember that you are at least you are here. Yeah, you grew up. You obviously must have done something right, otherwise you wouldn't be here. There must have been some success with your parents. So because of that, you can always have, you remind yourself of the good things they did. You remind yourself of when they forgave you, when you weren't really perhaps worthy of forgiveness, perhaps, I'm not sure. And all of that. And then you have a positive attitude towards your parents, or anyone else for that matter. And then you can do it with less feeling of just obligation. Yeah, the idea of filial you have to do it because of kind of the culture requires you to have filial piety. Then of course it becomes difficult. You try to change your perception of these things. Then it becomes better. Remember, one of the things the Buddha said about parents is that they are a very powerful field of merit. Yeah, if you treat your parents really badly, it's terrible bad karma. If you kill your parents, it's the kind of worst karma you can make. But the reverse is also true. If you treat your parents well, with love, with compassion, with understanding, you can also make enormous amounts of good karma. In fact, it is so important that in the Buddha's explanation of right view, he talks about parents. Yeah, that is how important it is. It's actually right there in right view. There is obligation to parents. So because it is there, it means that it is a very powerful source of good karma. So try to have a positive attitude when you have to do your obligations. If you can, it's going to be far more powerful for you. But it's not bad if you do it, even if you don't feel positive every time. That's almost impossible. Even if you feel a bit harsh, or you feel a bit negative, do it. Do it to the best of your ability. Try not to show the harshness. Try to be gentle, even though you may not feel 100% genuine inside. Okay. Oh, this is a long one. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, could you identify for us, step by step, the breath meditation and the signposts we meet before you get into deep meditation? For me, I have built up of energy in the head over a few days, and it gets stuck and doesn't go further. I've tried to let go, be kind and gentle, but to no avail. Also, I do not experience feelings of calmness like what some of them are experiencing. Please advise. Okay, so energy. And energy can be good, it can be bad, depending on what kind of energy it is. Yeah, energy. There's good energy, there's bad energy. It should be an energy which is positive, joyful, which is relaxed, which is at ease, not a tense kind of energy, an energy where you feel that it is a positive mental state. Everything in Buddhism can be either good or bad. Nothing is really good or bad by definition. It depends on the context, depends on all kind of criteria, whether it's good or bad. So these are the things that you should ask yourself. Are you feeling really relaxed? Are you really enjoying yourself? Are you feeling that, when you go out of the hall, or you go into the forest, or you look at your fellow retreatants, you have a kind of, you look at them with a, eyes of friendliness and eyes of compassion and care? Is that how you feel? Or do you feel more tense? Yeah. And this is the problem sometimes. You go on meditation retreat, if you're not ready, it can lead to tension instead of leading to relaxation. So this is what you have to. These are the things that you look out for. If you want to read about all the signposts of meditation, you should really read the Sutta on Mindfulness of Breathing. I believe Ajahn Brahm, did he go through the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta? Or maybe not? Did he? Yeah? Yeah? Okay. But if he didn't, then you can read that for yourself, and you can also listen to talks on the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta. It gives you all the signposts on the way. But as always, the most important thing is actually the starting point, when you start out. The Buddha says at the beginning of mindfulness of breathing, you have to have mindfulness. Yeah, if the mindfulness isn't strong enough, it's not going to work out. You may end up tense, you may end up with all these kind of things, using too much willpower or whatever, and then it's going to be coming too much willpower, then you can get this maybe some kind of wrong energy with too much willpower. So then you have to take one step back. What is it that gives rise to mindfulness? Now you know, yeah, because you saw that this morning, I taught you what gives rise to mindfulness. Mindfulness is caused by three kinds of good conduct. Yeah, that's where mindfulness comes in. So if you want to be more mindful, if you want the mindfulness of breathing to work, good conduct is really where it comes back to. How can you enable yourself to have good conduct all the time? Well, you have to have the right values in life. You have to have the right attitude. You have to come from the right place. This is where you need that right view. What matters? What is really important in this world? And it's interesting, once that right view gets established inside of you, then almost in everything you do, you will think, you will have some awareness at the back of your mind, am I doing this in the right way or not? You will feel that when you are angry, you can feel that you're coming from the wrong thing. You feel that something isn't quite right, and you will guide yourself in a different direction. Because the right view, your values are so firmly embedded, they will guide you almost at all times in your life. This is what happens when you become a stream mentor. Yeah, I mean, you may not be a stream mentor yet. Are there many stream mentors here? Maybe. Anyway, so but it doesn't matter if you are. But this is kind of the ideal of the stream mentor: is that when you are a stream mentor, you have full insight into the Buddha's teaching, and that's why your virtue is perfect, because your values are completely aligned with the Dhamma. You understand what is valuable in the world and what is not valuable, so we'll always be virtuous, that will always be at the back of your mind. So we try to get as close as we can to that ideal of the stream mentor. Make sure our view of the world is as close as possible to the reality that the Buddha saw. The idea of seeing things according to reality. And the closer they are, the more it will be at your mind at all times, and you'll be able to practice in the right way. So right view, this idea of reflecting wisely, is actually incredibly important on the Buddhist path. And it is quite common for meditation to get a bit stuck. It's a very common thing. Because you tend to plateau, you come to a plateau, it doesn't go any further, you've begun quite well. And the reason why you tend to plateau is because your mind is only developed to a certain stage. And you get to that point, and then you can't get any further. So very often what you have to do is you have to just develop more, develop all the other factors of the path. Keep on practicing in the right way. And as you do that, next year or next time you come to a retreat, the plateau will be a little bit higher before you stop. And then you kind of lift up the plateau all the time, and you change that base that you are practicing from. Sometimes you have like a lucky break, and you kind of break through that plateau, and bang, you go into some kind of marvelous and wonderful state. But it doesn't happen that often. Sometimes you just have to put in that work. Okay. Dear Ajahn, can you please elaborate more about how a Buddhist should do reflection? You talked about you in the sutta session. One, if a Buddhist is being humiliated, victimized, and treated unfairly, how does one practice this reflection? Should a Buddhist fight for what is right? Thank you. If you are being humiliated and victimized and treated unfairly, then of course there are. What you should do is ideally try to get out of that situation if you can. It is no point in kind of staying in a situation where you are abused. And very often people stay in difficult relationships and difficult jobs far too long and have to endure all kind of problems because of that. But remember, your life is important. That you have a good life matters. It is your life. And sometimes you just have to take responsibility for that life. And you have to know the right time to call it quits, whether it's a relationship or it's a job or whatever it is, because it just doesn't work out. At the same time, it is also useful to do your best to have compassion and understanding for the perpetrator, the person who does this. If someone is humiliating you and victimizing you and treating you unfairly, this person has a big problem. Yeah, because it's probably not just you, it's probably other people as well. They are doing, probably feel really bad about themselves, probably feel really rotten about themselves when they because of this. And they are creating their own suffering. They are blind, they are deluded, no idea what they're doing here. They are completely, you know, they're living in darkness, essentially. The lights are off and they have no idea, they are causing all kind of problem for themselves. There's a beautiful simile in the suttas for coming into light, coming out of the darkness. This is what insight is about. And if you are in darkness, what happens is that you bump your head all over the place, or you stub your toes, or whatever you do, and you hurt yourself because you're in darkness. And this is what happens when people are deluded. They are in darkness, no idea what's going on, and because of that, they suffer. Yeah, the bumping your head is like saying something bad to somebody, like bumping your head. Yeah, and then you suffer as a consequence of that. So these people are foolish. They don't know what they're doing. They're blind. They're causing suffering for themselves. Everybody wants to be happy, and they are causing suffering for themselves. They think that they're causing happiness for themselves, otherwise they wouldn't do it. But actually, they're causing suffering here. So what are you going to do if a person is blind? If they have no idea what they're doing? They have been programmed in the wrong way. Yeah, they went to the wrong religion, maybe. Or they... Born in the wrong family, yeah, or in the past life they were kind of in whatever, yeah. Who knows what they were in the past life? And because of that bad conditioning, now they are deluded, they're blind, they don't know what they're doing here. How can you get angry with a person like that? It's like getting angry with someone who is blind and who is kind of walking into the wall all the time. If you saw a blind person walking into the wall all the time, would you have compassion or would you get angry? You wouldn't get angry, right? It would be crazy to get angry. Don't walk that way. You'd say, there's a wall there. You're just going to hurt yourself. Walk this way instead. You'd have compassion for them if they're blind. And it's exactly the same thing with people who are humiliated and do bad things. They are blind. They are walking into that wall all the time, hitting their head, hurting themselves, not knowing what they're doing. You have to somehow bear the brunt of their stupidity. That's because you are in the wrong place. So what you do then, you remove yourself from being in the wrong place, but you can also have compassion for them because you understand that this person is just completely foolish and they have no idea what they're doing here. And this is beautiful because the world is full of people who do silly things like this, who humiliate others, who are harsh, who are violent, who treat people badly. There's a lot of people like this in the world. Not the majority of people, but there's a kind of a substantial minority like this. So because of that, it is a very useful thing to be able to learn, to have that kind of compassion. Because people really create their own darkness inside. They create their own suffering so badly. And then you can gradually move and you can change. And after a while, you start to either have metta for people because they're good people, or you have compassion because they don't know what they're doing here. And those two things, metta and compassion, combined in this way, will take you a long, long way. Everybody in the world can be regarded in this way. And then you should, in theory, you no need to ever get angry again in the future. Should you fight for what is right? Sure. Yeah, you can fight for what is right. But if you want to fight for what is right, make sure you do it in the right way. Without getting too angry, without kind of causing trouble. Do it with a sense of being fair to everyone. We're trying to help everyone, even trying to help perhaps the perpetrator if you can. But yeah, sometimes it's okay to fight a little bit, because if you are in a company where someone is a tyrant and everybody is suffering, then sometimes it's better to get rid of the tyrant than everyone suffering. So sometimes it's okay, but you know, don't take it too far. There comes a point when it is right to give up. There comes a point when you just have to resign and you just have to kind of say, okay, I've tried it, can't be done, and then just move on instead. So if you're going to take up a fight, it's often good to have an exit, so you don't kind of put yourself in an impossible situation. So if you're going to take up a fight, make sure that you have the possibility of resigning if it gets too hard, for example. Otherwise, you may just suffer even more by picking a fight with someone who's difficult. Okay. Okay, what is a secular Buddhist? Can one be a Buddhist and yet reject its more unfathomable tenets, such as rebirth? What is a secular Buddhist? Okay, can you be a Buddhist and reject rebirth, for example? In my opinion, not really. I think if you reject rebirth, you are rejecting one of the fundamental aspects of Buddhism, which is so fundamental that you can't really understand dukkha, you can't understand suffering without it, you can't understand the meaning of awakening or enlightenment without it. Everything is really distorted without completely if you take out rebirth. In fact, rebirth is a pillar in the Buddhist teaching that is so strong, you take away the pillar, everything collapses in a sense. Everything changes in meaning. And you may have noticed certain authors that write books about Buddhism, and they take rebirth out of the equation, and then they have to rewrite everything. Yeah, everything gets a new meaning here. Enlightenment has a new meaning. Dependent origination has a new meaning. Suffering has a new meaning here. Yeah, one of the books that I had a look at, I didn't read it because I couldn't bear to read it, but the one of the things in this book was the idea that it's not craving that causes suffering. It is suffering that causes craving here. That was the kind of the idea, yeah? So turning Buddhism upside down, this is kind of the idea of this book, yeah? So instead of craving causing suffering, suffering causes craving. And it is true. It is true that suffering can cause craving, because if you suffer really badly and everything is really terrible, sometimes you crave for, you know, for some outlet. And most people, the outlet if you suffer is sensual pleasures. Yeah, you know, people feel depressed, they go to the fridge and they eat something extra, or you get some entertainment, or you enjoy yourself in a certain way because you want to get out of the suffering. Yeah. The ways that ordinary people deal with suffering is by enjoying sensual pleasures. The way that a noble person deals with suffering is to understand that this is the way it is, and as soon as it passes, you go back and you go into meditation instead. That's how you deal with it if you are a noble person. But most people deal with suffering usually by some kind of sensual pleasure. So there is some truth to that, that you know, when you suffering leads to craving, but that's not the point of the Buddha. That's not what he's talking about. What he's talking about, the second noble truth, is craving leading to suffering. That's the whole point. So it is very problematic. Can you call yourself a Buddhist? I would say that if you are a beginner, you don't know much about Buddhism, and you are confused, you haven't really don't know so much about these teachings, you maybe even for the first few years, okay, fine, it's okay. You don't have to believe in rebirth straight away. You at least have the right to question it and to be neutral about it. But if you've been a Buddhist for a long time and you reject rebirth outright, then I'm not so sure whether you can really call that a Buddhist anymore, because you're not taking refuge in the Buddha. The Buddha said there is rebirth. You're rejecting what the Buddha said. Well, how can you, if the Buddha was enlightened, in a sense you are rejecting his enlightenment, aren't you? Because you're saying he doesn't know what he's talking about. So that, I think, is very problematic indeed. I don't think that there is such a big difference in Buddhism between what you might call secular Buddhism on the one hand and religious Buddhism on the other hand. Is rebirth, is that a religious thing? Or is rebirth a secular thing? Well, as far as I'm concerned, rebirth is just part of reality. It's just part of how life works. So is it really religious? Well, in my opinion, it's not really religious. What is religious? Religious to me is maybe more if you... it depends on how you define these things. But religion is sometimes believing in things for which there is no reason for believing in. Yeah, something which is kind of pure fantasy or whatever. Some people would say rebirth is fantasy, but to my opinion, rebirth is not fantasy at all. It's just the way that the universe happens to work. So to me, it is perfectly secular. There's no particular kind of religious component to that. And I think that there are certain secular Buddhists who actually do believe in rebirth and still call themselves secular Buddhist. And the reason they call themselves secular Buddhist is because they don't want to take part in all the rituals and all the kind of traditional things that many Buddhist people do. Many people do treat Buddhism as a religion, yeah? They go to pray to the Buddha, oh Buddha, please help me, I'm suffering so much, you know, I need a new car, please give me a new car, Buddha, you are all powerful. Or But people actually do these things, you know, and that's where Buddhism becomes kind of a religion. Or all you do is you go and kind of you all you do is chanting all the time. That's all you do in your Buddhist practice. I know a lot of Buddhists who I would call superstitious, to be perfectly honest with you, and that's okay. I mean, people are. I don't want to make fun of people who have superstitions, because that's just another condition. But there are lots of, you know, of these kind of things in Buddhism. But rebirth is, to me, not one of those things. Rebirth is a fundamental part of it. And I think there's no real contradiction, in my opinion, between being a secular Buddhist and believing in rebirth. It gets problematic because it depends on how we define religion. Is Buddhism a religion? Maybe. Maybe not. To me, Buddhism is a psychology. It's about how to develop your mind. It's about how to change your outlook. It's about how to achieve the end of suffering. It's about feelings. It's about being happy. It's about psychology, really, in my opinion. Is it religious? Maybe, maybe not. Anyway. Okay. Dear Ajahn, what is the death process like? What can we do during death to bring us to a good rebirth or liberation? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. What is the death process like? Well, it depends on how you lived your life. Yeah, if you lived your life well, usually the death process is a very pleasant experience. And one of the reasons why it is pleasant is because most people, when they die, the body is pretty, I was going to say something, some dodgy word, but the body is pretty bad. Yeah, the body is no good when you come to your, either you're very old or you're very sick from cancer or whatever, and the body basically has had it. So dying is often quite nice. And one of my most interesting experiences was actually going to Ajahn Brahm to a hospital and seeing, it was at this one time when I went with him, there was a young woman there. She was dying of cancer. She was only in her 20s. Sometimes people in their 20s also get cancer. And she was dying. And the family was sitting there. And Ajahn Brahm knew her quite well because she had been coming to a meditation group for quite a few years. And as soon as Ajahn Brahm went in there, Ajahn said, "Hooray! Yeah, finally you're getting rid of the body. Enjoy the process. It's going to be so nice of you. This body is not good anymore. Look at this body. It's useless. Yeah. Now you're going to leave this body behind. Hooray!" Yeah, and after a little bit of this, this girl had a smile on her face. Yeah, she looked really happy here. And because Ajahn Brahm knew that she was ready for this kind of message, he gave her this kind of very positive message about death. Death is a liberating experience when your body is in such a terrible condition. So death isn't necessarily bad. Yeah, this is the weird thing about it. Death is often a good thing, especially if someone is older. And if you really have compassion for somebody, if you have metta for somebody, sometimes you want them to die, yeah, because you realize that actually there's no point in going on anymore. And this is why sometimes euthanasia or voluntary assisted dying, they call it here in Australia, I don't know what they call it elsewhere, VAD, is sometimes it's okay, because you had enough, you don't want to go on anymore, why should other people force you to go on if you don't want to go on? It doesn't make any sense. Sometimes people just want to get out of here, and that's okay. So especially if you have lived your life well, very often it's a very happy and very pleasant experience. So on your deathbed, you just want to relax, you want to chill. Keep those blooming Christians out of your room when you're dying here. No, because that just messes up the whole process of happiness if you get people who are going to convert you on the deathbed. It's crazy stuff. It's really, really silly. So instead, be peaceful, be at ease, and enjoy the process. And if you are a relative of someone who's dying, don't cry. Be positive instead. Go in there and tell the person who's dying all the positive things in their life, all the things that you approve of them for, all the good qualities they have. Lift their spirits up to make them feel happy. Yeah, this is such a wonderful thing to do. One of the best things I did, I remember my father his cancer was getting quite bad. Eventually he died by falling down a staircase and kind of crushing himself on the stone floor. But he was dying anyway because of the cancer, and the cancer made him weak. And one of the things I did only a few weeks before he died was I wrote him a long letter just saying all the things I appreciated in him, all the wonderful qualities. He was a very special man in many ways. So I wrote down all the kind of things I appreciated in him. And it was such a it was a wonderful thing to do, yeah? One of the last things I did for my father before he passed away. Yeah? It's a very powerful thing. And this is ideally the way we can help somebody on their deathbed, is to support them in this way, by doing something positive towards the end, lifting their spirits, getting them ready for the passing away, and then it's going to be even happier as a consequence. So remember that, it's often good to take that opportunity straight away, because very often we don't know when the last opportunity is. So if you feel that there are things you should like to say to people in your family or to people you know that you haven't said, never wait, do it now, because now is the opportunity. People may be dead tomorrow. So do that, and this way you support yourself, you support the other person, and everyone gets lifted up because of that. So this is how the dying process usually what happens. Yeah, you're gradually, as you're coming close to death, you start to realize you're coming close. And as you're coming close to death, it is useful to, if you are ready, if you have a good mind, you will be able to let go of this world, because you know you can't hold on anymore. If you have done a bit of death contemplation in the past, if you've done some death meditations, learning to let go of things, it will be even easier. Yeah, you know you're dying, you can't hold on anymore. Everything has to go. Everything has to go. All your friends, everything you own in this world, so much of your identity which is tied up with this world, your body, all you have left is your mind. And if that is a beautiful mind, if you build up a beautiful mind in this life, that is what you take with you. This is why you want to build up something powerful and beautiful in this very life. You have all the good memories, and you take, you know, the gold with you into the future. Those people who haven't done that, those people who have lived a life of, just thinking about material things, only thinking about their status, thinking about relationships, thinking about all these worldly things, when they die, and very often people who think about the worldly things all the time, very often they also do bad things to get there. Why? Because if the worldly things are really important, you will compromise your morality to get those worldly things done. And then when you die, everything has to go. You compromise your morality for things that you have to abandon. What a terrible deal that is. Yeah, you compromise your morality, did lots of bad things. Now you have, all you have left is a bad mind, and you have to take that into the future. All those things that you compromise your morality for, they have to be left behind. If you think about it, it's completely, it's madness, yeah? And this shows you one of the powerful reasons why the idea of rebirth really matters, because it changes your idea of how to live, what matters in life. What matters is how we live, not what we do, because the whats are so ephemeral, they only last so long. Before you know it, it's all gone. The how you live, that is what you take with you. The goodness of your heart, that is what carries on into the future. So the most important thing with having a good death is really just to live well now, yeah? And when you live well now, you don't have to do very much on your deathbed. On your deathbed, just relax, just enjoy, don't try to control anything, don't try to do the right thing, and make sure the right people come to visit you. I don't know if you heard a story from Ajahn Brahm, a story of a nun. She was a Tibetan nun, and she was living here in Perth, she was dying of cancer, and she had this, Ajahn Brahm went to visit her, she had this note on her door and said, "No visitors," and then a small writing, "Except for Ajahn Brahm," underneath. And the reason was because all of these people, they were just crying, "Oh no, you're dying, oh it's terrible, oh please don't die." "What do you mean please don't die? I got cancer, I don't have a choice, go away." And then Ajahn Brahm just tells a few jokes and says a few nice things. And then she feels better, yeah? And that's kind of the right way to do things. People have to die. We can't hold on to them. It doesn't make any sense. Instead, we encourage them to be peaceful and say some nice and good things to them instead. Yeah? Okay. Okay, Christian missionaries have built hospitals, orphanages, and provided social services to help the masses wherever they propagate their religion, even in many Buddhist countries. The missionaries are more active in social services than Buddhists. In contrast, huge amounts of money is used to build lavish, extravagant pagodas, temples, or excessive gifts for monks. How should Buddhists catch up on social services? This is a very good point, and I can only agree with you that very often we waste a lot of money in Buddhism on really silly things. And it's quite hard to sometimes to get people to see common sense and use money wisely. We use the money in such a way that we not only do we not provide social services, but we actually corrupt Buddhism at the same time by using money in stupid ways. So the right way of using money in Buddhism is to support the teaching so it doesn't get corrupted. Support organizations and institutions that work well, that provide the goods, that live in the right way, that live with integrity, that live simply. Buddhists should really be relatively frugal. It shouldn't be kind of gold and marble and this kind of stuff everywhere. And ideally, monastics should live simply. Ajahn Brahm is an incredibly good example. He's one of the most famous monks in the world. And look at how he lives. He lives really, really simply. You all went to his cave today, is that right? You saw his cave, yeah? That's how he lives, yeah? He sleeps on the floor in his cave and lives a very simple life as a monk. And this is such a wonderful example. He's so famous that it doesn't go to your head. You still continue living in the right way. And what a wonderful thing that is. It's not easy to find examples like that. It's very special. And I'm very happy to have a teacher because hopefully it means I will be able to follow up and live in a similar kind of way myself. So don't stop charity to Buddhism, but do it wisely. It is so important. Don't corrupt the monastics. Don't corrupt the institutions. Don't build stupas for the sake of building stupas. Too often we hear that building stupas is great merit. Is it? It doesn't say in the suttas. The Buddha never said that. Build stupas and make lots of merit. But the way the Buddha said, if you're going to make an act of generosity, there are certain qualities you should have to do an act of generosity. One of the really nice things to do, the Buddha says, is to help build a kuti for a monastic, for example. That is a very high kind of generosity. Why? Because it helps us sustain Buddhism in the future. Because if we have good monastics around, then it is very likely that we will also have awakening, we will have jhanas, we will have all of these profound things that will enable us to sustain Buddhism in the future. Not just monastics, lay people as well, but certainly having a good monastic community is a very, very useful. So doing that in the right way is very useful. Building stupas, is that useful? And I think not really very useful at all. When people say it is a lot of good karma to build stupas, I don't know where they get it from, probably some kind of text that was written 1,000 years after the Buddha. Nobody knows who wrote the text. It's some kind of random work. And don't be careful. Don't just trust those things randomly, because if you do, then you often get taken for a ride. There's one place, I think, in the suttas where it talks about stupas, and that's in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where the Buddha says that anyone who goes to a stupa that contains the relics of the Buddha, because the Buddha was there, and they do something nice to that stupa, they will attain joy and happiness or something like that. But that's only once in the suttas, and it is specifically for the stupas that actually, where the Buddha passed away, commemorates the Buddha. Most stupas today, they are kind of just random stupas for all kind of things. I think a lot of that is not very meaningful anymore. So be a little bit circumspect. Think a little bit independently. Don't just follow along like everyone else. Then you will be doing things in the right way. And then, of course, if we spend less money on building enormous stupas, if we are going to build stupas, let's build simple ones, cheap ones, nothing kind of extravagant. One of the terrible things that they did recently, which I think is really bad news, the Mahabodhi temple, the big stupa at the Bodh Gaya in India, they topped it up with gold. They gold-plated the spire of that stupa. This to me is exactly the wrong way to go. The idea of the Bodh Gaya temple is to commemorate the Buddha. The Buddha was a man who lived a simple life, a man who did not suggest that we should kind of strive after all these material things and gold in particular. And then in the poorest part of India, where there's massive poverty, I mean, this is in Bihar state, this is the absolutely the bottom of the pile in India, you build this temple, which is like a temple which is now covered with, I don't know how much, probably hundreds of thousands, or maybe millions of dollars in gold that this kind of the spire of this temple is clad in. Sends completely the wrong message about what Buddhism is about. But people think it's good karma, so they do this kind of things. Actually, I happen to know some of the people who finance that, and I can't really tell them, unless they ask me if it's right, I can't really tell them you're being silly, because you have to be careful what you say, otherwise people get even worse views as a consequence sometimes. But these are what I think really incredible waste of money. And not only waste of money, actually it's bad. It leads to the detriment, to the downfall of Buddhism in the long run. So, indeed, and if we do change these things, if we start spending money in the right way instead, use it on social services, there will be lots of money left over in Buddhist circles. There are lots of Buddhists who are well off and who could spend money on these things instead. And it is a wonderful thing to do as a Buddhist, because you are creating good karma if you do things in the right way. If you look after things and you support, it is always a positive thing to do. So if you have a chance to do something good, always do that. I know in Singapore you have some good organizations who do the right thing. I know the BF does some social service and things. So please see it as an opportunity to do good karma. I think one of the differences between Buddhism and Christianity is that Christianity is very much a religion that has to do with this world. It is how we live this life that matters. Whereas Buddhism is a little bit otherworldly. It's a bit more about our mind, and how and doing meditation practice and kind of escaping this world. So the attitude is a little bit different. We don't need to turn Buddhist into Christians. We don't have to kind of follow exactly what the Christians do. But yes, we can probably do more social service and spend our money in wiser ways, but not perhaps quite as far as Christianity, where that becomes the end of the practice in its own right. We should remember it's only part of the practice, and there are other things that ultimately probably matter even more. Okay. In the instruction to Bahiya, the Buddha taught, in the seeing there is only the seen. The same goes for the other sense bases. How does contemplating the six sense bases lead to the insight of anatta, non-self? There are also many suttas towards the end of the Majjhima Nikaya that expounds or whatever the six sense bases and anatta, like Majjhima Nikaya 148, 149, etc. Okay, so remember the contemplation of anything should always be based on meditation practice. Contemplation is not something you do which is dry. You just sit back and think, the eye is non-self, forms are non-self. If you think, it doesn't really go very far. So you have to base your, almost all contemplation has to be based on meditation experiences. If you base it on that, then it's going to be powerful. So how do you do that? It's not just the six sense bases, also the five aggregates is exactly the same thing. If you look at the Anapanasati Sutta, and you look at what happens during the process of Anapanasati, what is happening is that there is a transformation of the five aggregates, and also a transformation of the sense bases as you do that. The five aggregates are actually changing as you're becoming more peaceful. If your breath meditation is working, then the body is starting to disappear. That's the form aggregate disappearing into the background. Your senses are starting to shut down. Your feelings are transforming from more coarse feelings to more refined and happy feelings. So your feelings are changing as you go through Anapanasati. Your perception of reality is changing because you're perceiving less and less. Eventually just the breath, maybe eventually just a beautiful nimitta if your meditation is going really well. So your perceptions are changing as you go through this. Your will is changing because there's less and less willing until the will is completely given up. So the whole process of the meditation practice is a change and a diminishment and a cessation and gradual elimination of the five aggregates. That becomes the ground for insight. When you see that things are changing, especially when you see that things are disappearing completely, you know that there must be non-self, because something which can disappear completely must be non-self by definition. Self is defined in the sutta as something that you can control. If something has ceased, you can't control it anymore because it's out of your reach. By definition, it is non-self, and you will understand it as non-self as a consequence. So you go through the process, you think back on the process, you see it as impermanent, you see it as suffering. Why? Because when all of these things cease, you become more happy. The less body there is, the happier you are. The less senses there is, the more happiness you have. The less you perceive, the more happiness there is. The less you will, the will is a nuisance. Yeah, the less will you have, the happier you are. So it's actually very simple. When you come out afterwards, the deeper your meditation is, the more insight you will have into the five khandhas according to the three characteristics: impermanence, suffering, and non-self. You will see these things very clearly. And this is one of the reasons why deep samadhi is so useful, because the deeper the samadhi is, the more things will have ceased, the more things will have been eliminated. And because they are eliminated, it's easy to have insight into impermanence, into cessation, into dukkha, and also into non-self. And it's exactly the same thing with the five senses. As the five senses cease, and that's what they do in deep meditation, the deeper meditation is, the less of the five senses there is left, they cease, they're completely gone. You know the I is non-self. You know it's dukkha, because you're much more happy without it. No I, wow, how nice, no eyes. Maybe I should kind of, no, don't do that. Maybe I should, there was a nun who plucked out her eye. You know that story in the Siddhas? She plucked out her eye. There was a man who liked this nun. He said, oh, your eyes are so beautiful. So she plucked out her eye and gave it to this man. This man said, okay, ooh. That's really cool, isn't it? It really shows you have no attachment to your eyes. And this is the thing about deep meditation. You have to get to that non-attachment to your eyes, first of all. Otherwise, you can't enter deep meditation, because you have to give up the possibility of seeing. When you come out afterwards, you know that seeing is just a pain in the, you know what? Yeah, it's a problem. It's not really useful. There's much more happiness without it. And because it isn't required, because you're better off without it, because you can't access it in deep meditation, you know it is non-self. The deeper you go, the more powerful these insights become. Reflect back on what happened. This is where insight comes. It comes also a little bit from trust, having confidence in these teachings. You realize that these things are probably non-self, but this is where the real insight happens. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Okay, this is exactly the same handwriting. Okay, I'll do that question afterwards. A German monk presiding over a retreat said that that is a self, atta, that goes from life to life, not subject to the law of anicca. Aha, okay. I spoke to his follower about it, and he said the Buddha did not say there is no self outside of the five aggregates. Only the five aggregates is anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Is that correct? The Buddha said that sabbe dhamma anatta. Yeah, dhamma is everything. Dhamma is inclusive of absolutely everything. So sabbe dhamma means that everything is without a self. He didn't say five aggregates. He says all dhammas are without self. And the Buddha said that if anyone finds a self anywhere, it is always in the five aggregates. That's the only place where a self resides. That's the only place where a self can be, because it's the only thing you can relate to. So anyone who ever sees a self, it is only seen in the five aggregates. Yeah, that's where it's seen. So anyway, so still, if you see a self outside of the five aggregates, actually it's not outside, it's all still part of the five aggregates. So what it means is that this person was still trapped by one of the five aggregates, because that is the only place where you can see a self. That's really what it means. One of the problems in Buddhism, and one of the problems in all teachings anywhere any kind of religious teachings, is that there is a very powerful tendency of human beings to want to find some permanent essence in life. Yeah, we all want there to be something, the real me inside, the real I which is always there. There's a very powerful force inside of us that wants to find a self, the real me. And because that force is so strong, it is very, very common in Buddhist circles to have what you call eternalist view. This is really just an example of an eternalist view. The idea that something carries on forever, that there is a real self there. Once Buddhism has an eternalist view like that, it is basically no different from any other kind of religion. If you look at the Hindu religion, the Brahmanical religion, it is all about finding union with Brahma, union with the highest God, and then carrying on for eternity in the permanence of Brahma or something like that. If you look at the ancient Christian mystics and sages who practiced meditation as well, they had the idea of attaining unity with God, the similar kind of thing, an eternal source of God, but it was always there. If you make that Buddhism into that, it just becomes part of what every other religion is, and you might as well, it becomes no different from anything else. But the Buddha says the one thing which is different in his religion from everything else is the idea of non-self. There is no essence there. Not just in the five khandhas, anywhere. Sabbe dhamma anatta, all dhammas are without self. And anyway, if you find a self, it's always within the five khandhas anyway. The Buddha says in another Lakkhana Sutta, all consciousness, there is no self, for example. So if there is no consciousness, if there is no ability to be aware of anything, well then of course there is nothing here. If all consciousness is non-self, then there isn't anything else outside of that that could be a self, because you cannot find, nothing can exist outside of consciousness, because it doesn't, you have to be conscious of something for it to exist, otherwise it doesn't exist, as far as we are concerned. But be careful, because this is one of the very strong and powerful streams anywhere, is this push towards eternalism. Everybody wants eternalism. Not everybody, but many people do, because of the very powerful tendencies in all beings, basically. Okay. The Buddha taught that all dhammas arise due to attention, just as Vedana arises from contact, citta from nama rupa, etc. Can it be said that craving and delight for the five aggregates and the arising of the fetter in the six sense spaces is due to wrong attention? Yes, absolutely. It is precisely right. Is all due to wrong attention? Wrong attention comes in many, many forms. Some of these wrong attentions, like delighting in the five aggregates and craving for the five aggregates, is a very deep-seated thing, because it is basically about, the craving to exist. And the craving to exist is very, very deep-seated. If someone says they're going to come and kill you, and you say, please go ahead, that means you have no craving to exist anymore. But if you say, please, no, I'm not ready yet, wait till I become an arahant, it says, okay, I'll wait till an arahant, and it's okay. So this is very, very deep-seated thing in human beings. We want to carry on, we don't want to die. So that kind of wrong attention is not the first thing to think about. The first kind of wrong attention is the wrong attention which gives rise to ill will, and also powerful desires in life. These are the first ones to eliminate, because they are the most problematic ones. And then further down the path, you can also eliminate these other kinds of wrong intention. That's precisely right. The fetter in the six sense spaces, this is from the suttas. And that comes in a variety of forms, those fetters. And that fetter can be just a very coarse fetter, like a desire for some object of the senses. Or it can be just a fetter because you want the senses to exist, because it's part of your personality, who you take yourself to be. So yes. Okay. Okay, I've already been going now for an hour and a half. So if you feel tired, you want to go back, you had enough, and you don't understand what's going on anyway. There's always, people are so different. There are some people know a lot, and some people are newcomers. Is anyone who's a newcomer here? You're a newcomer. Okay. Okay, newcomer. Okay. Are you all right? Yeah? Okay. Yeah? Okay. Still enjoying it? If you don't enjoy, you're welcome to go back. Yeah? It's okay. Yeah. It's up to you. Please, there's no, I don't demand that people stay here. If people want to leave, it's perfectly okay. Yeah. Anyway. Bhante, is there a good translation in English of the commentaries to the suttas, such as the Majjhima, Attakatha, etc.? There is very hard to come across any translation at all, let alone a good translation. Really, really difficult. And so there are some translations that have come out. I saw one in Sri Lanka when I was in Sri Lanka a few years ago. There were some Sri Lankan scholars done some translations. So there are some translations available, but only partly done for part of the Majjhima Nikaya or something. Not really a lot. So it's very, very hard. You get a little bit of translation if you read Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations, because he has some comments in the back where he translates a little bit. Yeah. So, but it is very hard. Basically, I wouldn't be too concerned. If I were you, you start reading the commentary. Sometimes it can be interesting. A lot of the time, it's just plain old boring, not really all that useful. Yeah. If you think the suttas are boring, the commentaries are far worse. Yeah. The suttas are kind of, wow, exciting compared to the commentaries. And the Abhidhamma is even more boring again. So I wouldn't recommend you to read the Abhidhamma. That's kind of has all these long lists of stuff. Yeah. There are 96 of that, 25 of this, and it gives you a long list. Then it gives you 15 synonyms for each one of those. And it kind of goes on like that forever. And the Abhidhamma is incredibly boring. And also very long. Yeah. You know how long the Abhidhamma is? I think someone did a calculation of how long the Abhidhamma is. There's one book in the Abhidhamma called the Patthana. It's the last book, the seventh book of the seven books of the Abhidhamma. And the Patthana is full of little dots in it, yeah? Dot, dot, dot. Because if you expanded all those dots, the book would be so long that the spine of the book would stretch for about 1,000 kilometers. Yeah, I think they said the distance between Canberra and Melbourne or something like that. No, not Canberra, Melbourne and Sydney, which is over about 1,000 kilometers. The spine of the book would be about 1,000 kilometers. So, is it worth reading? I'll leave it up to you to decide. But it's also incredibly boring. It's really good. If you can't go to sleep at night, really good. Abhidhamma, yeah. That's the best time to read it. If you're counting sheep doesn't work, Abhidhamma probably will work, yeah. So I'm being a bit naughty now, but I would never really recommend anyone to read the Abhidhamma, because it is really superfluous. The teachings of the Buddha are far plentiful enough, and if you can read that, then you're already doing really, really well. For most people, if you're a Buddhist monk, you know, okay, read a little bit of Abhidhamma just to get a feeling for what it's like. But for most lay people, I think it's, to be honest, a waste of time to read the Abhidhamma. So, that is the Attakathas. Again, many interesting questions here. One more question. Okay, you can't just keep them coming, you know, because this is going to have to come to an end. Did they? Okay. Okay, no more questions now, okay? That's the last one here. I don't take any more questions, sir. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, you have spent a lot of time with Ajahn Brahm. Which of his character conduct do you find remarkable? Okay, so there are lots of things as Ajahn Brahm that are really quite amazing. But one of there's many, many things about him that is kind of astonishing. He's incredibly generous person. He never really says no. If he has even the tiniest smidgen of energy to do anything, he will say yes. He will wear himself out because he wants to do things. Because his love of the Dhamma, his love of meditation, his love of the Buddhist path is so great that he always wants to share with anyone wherever he has the opportunity. So he always has incredible generosity of heart. In the Sangha, he will be the first one to open the door for a junior monk and let the junior monk come in. Yeah, he will always do acts of kindness, acts of generosity. Even though he is one of the most famous monks in the world, he is incredibly humble, incredibly generous, incredibly kind person. So this is one of the things about him. And one of the things that you realize when you read the suttas is that these are precisely the sort of character traits you expect of someone who has gone a long way on the Buddhist path. This is exactly how they're supposed to be. Yeah? So this gives me a lot of confidence when I see Ajahn Brahm acting in these ways, because he really has the character traits of a great person. He has the energy and he has the generosity. He's getting a bit older now, and he's getting, let's face it, he's getting a little bit overweight. Yeah, we have to tell the truth about these things, and of course that holds you back a little bit. Yeah, he's not in very good physical shape and all of that, so it means that his energies are going down. But still, he does what he can with his slightly less energy than he had before. Yeah. This is one of the characteristics of Ajahn Brahm. Yeah. One of the other ones, he has a very light mind. Yeah, he tends to be very happy. He tends to be very light. He's never really, you don't see Ajahn Brahm depressed. Yeah, I know that's kind of unheard of. I've been with him 25 years, never depressed. He might get a bit serious sometimes, but never sad or depressed. Yeah, always very bright and light mind. And this is another character trait you expect of someone who's spiritually advanced. They have a light bearing about them. They're not heavy. They're not kind of, you know, morose, or whatever you want to call it. So that is another thing. Yeah.
Is he very close to being an arahat?
Now that is something that I will leave you to judge. I'm not going to judge that one. You have to judge that for yourself. And the other thing, which is very impressive with Ajahn Brahm, is he's incredibly independent. Yeah, he always does his own thing. And I don't know if you have ever tried to control Ajahn Brahm, if you ever try to make him do certain things. This usually happens, yeah, if you're part of an organization together and you would like to kind of get Ajahn Brahm to teach the retreat, you try maybe to manipulate him. But if he gets the feeling that you are manipulating him, he will balk straight away. There's no way that he's going to go if you manipulate him. He has this incredibly independence about him. He does things his own way. And he doesn't really care what the rest of the world thinks. You may think that Ajahn Brahm is very, you know, he likes to please the crowd, he's a bit of a crowd pleaser, without telling jokes, tells nice stories, everyone has a good time. But also, he has integrity at the same time. He does what he thinks is right. If the whole world goes to the left, but he knows you should go to the right, he will go to the right. If all his friends say, don't ordain bhikkhunis, he will ordain bhikkhunis. Yeah, most people, we can't do that. We can't do it because if everyone else goes the opposite, we feel kind of, there's too much pressure. There's too much, I can't lose all my friends. Yeah, I can't be by myself in the world. But if you are spiritually advanced, you have independence. You have the Dhamma in your heart. Because you have the Dhamma in your heart, you can be alone. You're not afraid of doing what is right in the world and being independent. So he's incredibly strong. He doesn't need anybody. Yeah, he doesn't care. He doesn't really have. Whatever happens, he just shrugs his shoulders. Of course these things happen. If the whole monastery were to burn down tomorrow, Ajahn Brahm wouldn't kind of bat an eyelid, just go into his cave and meditate, and be probably very happy. Yeah, probably better for him if the monastery burnt down, and the Buddhist society exploded, and the and the Buddhist fellowship ceased to exist in Singapore, probably Ajahn Brahm would be happy, because less, no more work. Okay, now just meditate. Yeah, very, very happy. Yeah. And this is the beautiful thing about it. You know, you may remember that we had this big fire going through Bodhidharma Monastery. That was in 1991, and January the 30th. That was before I came to Bodhidharma Monastery. And he said that as soon as the fire went through, he thought the whole monastery would burn down. And as soon as he thought that, he let go of the whole monastery straight away. Yeah, bang, no problem at all. He didn't really care about the monastery. That was fine. He could let go of it. And that was despite the fact that he had worked on that monastery for 10 to 12 hours a day, building it up with his bare hands over the previous, 8 years or something? Yeah, working pretty much all the time. Still, he could let go just like that. How is that possible? And the reason is because he doesn't build it up to do something. He builds to get a result. He builds it up because he knows it's a good thing to do. He does it because it is a spiritual thing. This comes back to the idea I was talking about before. You don't do things for the results, because if you do things for the results, you're always going to get let down. Instead, you do it with the right attitude. It is how you do it that matters. And Ajahn Brahm does it with a spiritual attitude. With the attitude of doing something kind, of doing something generous for the world. Those qualities he has already built up inside of him by doing the acts. So if everything burns down, nothing is really lost. Beautiful. Yeah, it's a very good example of how to live in the right way. So if you come back to Singapore and Singapore is gone, Is that possible? Just shrug your shoulders. Okay, Singapore is gone. Yeah, now I can just chill. I can become a monk or a nun. Yeah, now I can do what is good in the world. Stay at Summer Grove, exactly. Yeah, come become a refugee at Summer Grove. Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah. So okay. Anyway, so this kind of gives you the idea. Yeah, imagine Singapore being gone. There's just a big this ocean there where Singapore was before. Malaysia is still there. Indonesia is there, but Singapore just ocean. Yeah. One day it may happen. Yeah, who knows what's going to happen in the future? Yeah. We have, you know, the rising sea levels in Singapore. There are a few kind of hills in Singapore, but not that many. Like everyone has to kind of scramble onto these little hills. 4 million people on these little hills. It can be very interesting here. Yeah. Anyway. So that is Ajahn Brahm. And he is very, Ajahn Brahm, he jokes a lot, but he is also incredibly wise. And it is worthwhile taking his jokes and his stories sometimes quite seriously. Listen for the Dhamma point in his stories. The Dhamma points are often very profound and very useful. They are not just stories. They actually have a lot of profundity to them. Often people don't, you know, it's good to laugh, but when you laugh, also think at the same time. Don't let it just be a joke. Don't let it just be a story. There's something more going on there. When Ajahn Brahm gives a question, sometimes he may be tired, sometimes his answer may not be all that interesting, but sometimes he gives very interesting answers. So listen to the answers. Listen when he talks. Don't just, don't just take it for granted or anything like that. Ajahn Brahm is very unassuming. He's a very humble person. He doesn't make much out of himself. He's not like a big shot, yeah? When he sits there, he just looks like any other monk. He doesn't look like much at all. But because he's unassuming, doesn't mean he doesn't have anything interesting to say. Actually, it is the other way around. It is precisely because he's unassuming that what he says is interesting. So you have to listen, to take on board all the things that he has to say. You have to be careful, and you have to have that openness of mind and that ability to take things on board. Okay. But carry on, otherwise we're never going to come to the end. So, okay. Oh, this is another one about a German monk. German forest monk told his retreatants that everything that happens is due to karma. Be it psychiatric disorders, injustices, is all karma. Is that true in the Buddhist sense? He said that his teacher, a Thai forest monk's stuffs were not stolen at the back of the car, while those of others were stolen. So it's all karma. Yeah. Now the problem is that a lot of the Thai forest monks, they are not all that educated in the suttas, and very often they will do things that they will say things that are culturally accepted in Thailand, for example. That is what I would call cultural Buddhism. It doesn't mean that they are bad monks. They may even be enlightened, perhaps, and they even have very good meditation. But their understanding of some of these concepts of Buddhism are not very good. And the idea that everything is due to karma is directly contradicted in the suttas. The Buddha says karma is only one of a number of things that contribute to how we experience the world and how we feel the world. In fact, the Buddha says that if everything we experience is due to what we did in the past, in other words, karma, the spiritual life becomes impossible. And the reason why it becomes impossible is because if everything we experience is due to past karma, it means that everything is already set. Nothing can be changed. Everything is already fixed beforehand. And then whether we practice or not, everything is already fixed. But it isn't like that. What we do in this life matters. If you are not careful, then that is one of the causes for why a car hits you in the street. If you don't look left or right or whatever it is, depending on which country you live in, if you don't look at the right direction and you just walk into the street, well, the car might hit you. Yeah, not because of karma, but because you're silly, because you're not looking. So if you are careless, carelessness leads to bad karma. This is a misunderstanding, and I think it's because this German monk is just following the teachings that he had received in the Thai forest tradition, and he hasn't really read the word of the Buddha. That's how these things tend to come out, this can be sometimes be a bit problematic. So even illness is often not because of karma, it's because of the body just going wrong. Illness is part of life. Everybody becomes ill sometimes. That's just what things are like. So if someone becomes ill, you don't blame them and say, ah, oh, it's your bad karma, it's your own problem, okay, just die if you have to. You know, you don't say that. You have compassion for people. You are kind. And even if it is bad karma, you're still kind. We all done bad karma in the past. So you're still kind regardless. So, there is an interesting course online. That was something that I did with Bhante Sujato a few years ago. It's called Karma and Rebirth in Early Buddhism. Yeah, it's available online. There's a website called Wisdom and Wonders that you can listen to that whole course that we did. And the first part of that course we called Myth Busting. Yeah. Busting all the myths. And this was one of those myths that we busted in that course. Yeah. So if you're interested in myth busting, you can go there. Yeah. And another one is with the idea that being reborn as a woman is bad karma. That's another one of those myths that you sometimes hear about. Actually, there's no evidence for that in the suttas at all. The Buddha never said that. Human beings, yeah? That is animals, okay, human beings. That is the difference. But if you're a human being, you're a human being, yeah. Anyway, we better move on. What happens if one has no will to live on, but yet went for all the health tests and perfect condition? How to keep them to die? How they have no meaning in life? Okay, so you have no will to live because you have no meaning in life or whatever. I think I get what you're trying to say here. So I guess it depends on what is happening here. Why don't they have any will to live? What is the reason for that? And if the health is really good, then it's probably they have some kind of psychological problem. Yeah, maybe they are depressed or something like that. They don't want to live. They don't want to carry on. Usually, if you are in really good health, it is advisable to carry on living because it is advised. It's a chance to practice, a chance to live well, a chance to do something good. Yeah, if you are depressed, you can do things to help you coming out of that depression, to become a more happy person or whatever. So if you have no will to live, you have to kind of help that person to find that will to live. Find some meaning. Find something they can do to kind of make life meaningful. At the very least, listen to some Dhamma. Do something, maybe teach them some meditation practice, even if they can't move very much or whatever. There's always things you can do as long as you are in reasonable health. It's only really if life becomes unbearable. You are heaps of suffering, you're about to die anyway, and life is completely unbearable. That is probably the only circumstance where you may consider that it would be right to have, something like voluntary assisted dying. But it should really be a very serious condition before you even consider that. In this kind of case, I would, instead of dying, I would consider this case to try to find some meaning for this person so they can carry on and actually do something with their life. Life is quite precious, yeah? There's always an opportunity to do something good. Always an opportunity to at least say some kind words or learn some Dhamma or to teach some meditation or whatever it is that you can do, even in the most difficult circumstances. Okay, so I probably speed up just a little bit. Dear Ajahn, should we as Buddhist laypersons be concerned about global warming? What can we do to mitigate the effects of global warming? So, should you be concerned about it? I think we should definitely be concerned about it because it is obviously becoming a very big problem. Yeah, every time the scientists come out with a new report, things are getting worse. Everybody says, it's exaggerated. But actually, it turns out to be worse every time. So, it can't really be exaggerated. So, in my opinion, it is absolutely a good reason to be concerned, especially if you have children. Yeah, they're going to have to grow up. They're going to have to live in this world. You have very good reason to be concerned that they can live in a world that is not too devastated by the effects of global warming. Obviously, something is happening. The vast majority, they say 95% of climate scientists agree that there is a massive problem out there. They're using more and more strong language, calling it global heating and global disaster and all of these kind of things, because it is quite bad. So what can you do? Well, I think what we should do is to, you know, if you live in a kind of democratic society, you should vote for politicians who take these things seriously, who will do something about it. This is the most important thing. You have to have, you really have to have, it has to happen at the government level. These are very serious things. You can't do a little bit personally, but really, this is sort of thing that has to be solved by governments. So you have to vote in the right governments. Should we go on demonstrations? I think sometimes demonstrations are useful. Yeah, there's big demonstrations happening recently in around the world. All the students have been demonstrating around the world. You have in the UK, and they had lots of demonstrations. They call it the Extinction Rebellion or something. And sometimes it's good to demonstrate, to show that you really care, you know, as long as it is legal and you're not doing something bad or wrong, as long as it's coming from a good heart because you want to solve something. A bit of demonstration is sometimes good if you do it in the right way. So when I see people demonstrating and I read about it in the news, I think, wow, actually, good on these people who demonstrate. They're actually helping us to understand the seriousness of these things. So I personally, I think that's a good idea. Would I demonstrate? I don't know if I would dare to go out there as a monk, I'm not sure, but I find it very brave to do these kind of things, because often it takes bravery to be able to do this kind of stuff. Anyway, so up to you how you want to be involved, certainly we can, at very least, we can vote for the right kind of people. Number two, what causes a person to be angry and lose his temper? How can you control your anger? So the reason why you get angry is because you focus on other people in the wrong way. Yeah, you see the negative thing, and when you see the negative thing, you blow that out of proportions, and then you kind of get angry and upset. So what you have to do is to, instead of focusing on the negative, remember the positive. And if the negative is still there, remember to have compassion. All the things I mentioned before, because a person with lots of negative qualities, they need compassion. They are in trouble. They are going towards suffering. They are in darkness. They are deluded. So something, you need to do something for them there. Okay. Dear Ajahn, can I know how do we separate the mind from the body? How to watch with our mind? Where is the mind? Please share with us your New Albany project. Thank you. Wow, that's many questions in one. Okay. Separating the mind from the body. All you really want to do is you want to keep the mindfulness, watch the breath, yeah? And as you do that, the separation happens over time. It is a gradual thing, as if you are removing yourself from the body and you're seeing things more and more at a distance. Maybe what you are referring to here is something in the Visuddhimagga called the Nama-rupa-pariccheda jnana. The Visuddhimagga is famous for its insight knowledges called the jnanas, and the first of those insight knowledges is called the Nama-rupa-pariccheda jnana, whereby your mind and body is supposed to be separated. Yeah, you get a kind of distance from the body or whatever it is. But don't worry so much about the Visuddhimagga. Just follow the practice of anapanasati, and this kind of separation will happen gradually. So again, if you use too much force on the breath, if you use too much willpower, then the separation will not really happen, because you're holding it too hard, you're grasping it. This is one of the reasons why relaxing is so important, because as you relax, as things fade away, meditation starts to happen, and then this separation happens automatically over time. So just keep doing the breath meditation, investigate what you're doing, gradually you will get it right, and then these things will happen for you. How to watch with your mind? So that's what you do, any watching is really with your mind, but it's like you stand back. It's like if you are watching a movie or something like that, you're kind of leaning back, watching the movie, you're not really involved, you're just allowing things to be. And the reason why you're able to watch the movie is because it's exciting, it's interesting. You don't lose track of what's going on because it's cool, yeah? But you don't have to force yourself with willpower to watch the movie. So ideally, the breath should be like a movie. So how do you make the breath into a good movie? How? You make it happy. Yeah, this is kind of the trick here. You have to make the breath as happy as possible. And to make the breath happy, you want to reduce willpower, because willpower tends to make the breath unhappy. It makes it unpleasant. So you have to make the present moment the pleasant moment. One of those nice catchphrases from Ajahn Brahma. Make the present moment the pleasant moment, and then it starts to happen. So you don't force it. You allow things to be here. You allow things to fade away. And then that watching with the mind happens. Where is the mind? The mind is everywhere. Wherever you feel something, the mind is there. Yeah? So wherever you have a feeling of something, so the reason you can feel yourself like this is because the mind somehow is related to the physical body. The mind is wherever feeling is present, wherever there's some experience of the world. Please share with us your new Albany project. Okay, it's just a small new monastery that is recently started in Albany. And we'll see what happens. It is only starting out. There's only one monk down there, and he has to do everything here. So he's probably very, very busy here. There's one monk, Venerable Mudu. And if you want to check it out, you can. You can I think they already have an internet page. I'm not sure what they have, actually, to be honest with you. But it's one of those things. It's just starting out. There's not much there. It's almost on the ocean. Yeah, very close to the Southern Ocean. After that, it's just Antarctica. There's penguins in the distance. Yeah, that's all there is. And a few sharks in between, of course. But that's all there is down there. So it's a very beautiful area. But quite a bit colder than here. So you probably think it's cold enough here already. Is that right? Most of you? So if you don't like the cold, it may not be the right place for you. But it's exciting. It's nice. We need to expand, because there's too many monks in this monastery here. So we need to kind of export a few monks, get rid of a few monks. So. Bhante, someone says you can be in any state of mind, be it a warrior, a poet, a guru, a religious leader, I presume a criminal, swindler too, as long as you are not attached to it. Is that the Buddhist sense? The point is that if you are a warrior, if you are any of these things, usually what that implies, it implies bad intentions, because being a warrior means you have to intend to kill. If you are a criminal, you have to intend to do crimes. So if you intend to do crimes, you're making bad karma. You're going against the path. With this kind of not being attached to it, it's very kind of a superficial way of looking at it. It's not about whether you're attached to it or not. It's about whether you're making good karma or not. If you're making bad karma, it's bad, regardless of whether you don't feel attached to it. You probably are attached to it anyway. It's just that you don't feel attached to it. But it's bad, yeah? So what happens is that if you do bad things, it has bad consequences. If you have bad intentions, you feel bad about yourself. In that sense, you are attached to it. It's impossible not to feel bad about yourself if you do bad things. You have to feel bad about yourself. And this is one of those things that is so useful to notice. Notice that you feel bad about yourself when you do bad things, because it really puts you off doing bad stuff. If you say something bad to somebody, often afterwards you think, wow, that wasn't very nice. Why did I say that? You feel bad about yourself. That is like the immediate karma from doing something bad. If you see that connection, it puts you off doing bad things. But because we have a sense of self, it means we have to take ownership of the bad things we do. You have no choice. You can forgive yourself a little bit, but you can't forgive yourself completely. That's impossible. You always have to take some degree of ownership of the bad things that you do. And because of that, you will always feel bad about yourself if you do bad things. It's impossible not to be attached in that sense. Except if you're an arahant, and if you're an arahant, you are incapable of doing those bad things anyway. Yeah? So there you are. That's really how it works. So the whole idea is being a warrior, not being attached to it, is meaningless. It doesn't mean anything. It's gobbledygook. It's not completely, yeah, anyway. So we're coming to the end, I'm happy to say. Someone says Buddhism is cold and unfeeling. Even a monk commented that Buddhism is too rational and intellectual and probably has no room for warm feelings. What is your view on this? I think it is not right. It is complete nonsense. Buddhism is highly emotional. If you know how to practice it in the right way, it's all about metta and kindness and karuna and compassion. It's about happiness and joy on the Buddhist path. It's about overcoming anger and all these kind of things. Buddhism is an emotional path. Without emotions, you can't go very far on this path at all. We're talking about confidence and sadha and faith this morning. And ideally, when we do that recitation of the Itipiso that we did earlier on today, those are the qualities of the Buddha. And the idea behind reciting the qualities of the Buddha, if you know what they are, the purpose of that is to give rise to some kind of emotion, because it reminds you of who your teacher is. And having a teacher like the Buddha is like, wow! You have a teacher like the Buddha, it's like, it's amazing! The Buddha is the greatest spiritual genius in human history, recorded and unrecorded history. He's like, stands head and shoulders above everyone else, and he's our teacher. Isn't that astonishing? You have access to the best spiritual teachings in the universe. You have them. They're yours for the taking. You can just have to practice them. So if you think about that in the right way, how can it not make you happy? How can it not make you uplifted? Sometimes we get happy about the most stupid things. You know, we get into a new relationship. Oh, so happy. Or we get into a... I'm being a bit naughty now, I apologize. Or you get a new promotion in your job. Yeah, I got a promotion. But these are nothing. These are not going to make you happy in the long run. These are kind of minuscule. You have the real big-time happiness in the Buddha's teachings. And very often when we read them, we don't get happy because we don't really appreciate what we have. This is kind of the point. So once you start to really appreciate who the Buddha is, the kind of his power, his insight into reality, his ability to teach the highest happiness, to overcome suffering, once you start to get that, actually it is a source of great inspiration and joy. And that joy, that happiness, is a sort of joy and happiness that will take you into deep meditation. But it's hard, yeah, it is hard. It is in the world, the more stressed out you are, the harder you work. And I know that in Singapore people work very hard, yeah. You still work Saturdays in Singapore, is that right? Some of you, yeah? So it's kind of, you know. Of course, if you work very hard, you get stressed out, you feel less because of that, and you know, all of these things become more difficult. So that is why it is so useful to come on a meditation retreat and chill out a little bit and try to build up these other qualities at the same time. So Buddhism lived well, lived rightly. Oops, sorry, Teddy. Lived rightly is a very emotional thing. It is the reason why we are kind, why we are generous, is to build up good emotions inside of us. So it is rational intellectual. It is rational intellectual if you start studying the Abhidhamma. This is one of the reasons why the Abhidhamma is so useless, because it is precisely encourages the rational and intellectual rather than the emotional. Okay, dear Ajahn, please explain how we were created. What is the purpose of life? Where do we go after we die? Okay, how you were created. You were created from craving. Craving in the past life created you who you are now. How were you originally created? There is no original. It's just craving before craving before craving. There's always more craving before that. There's no first point to craving. And because of that, craving is what has created you all along. That's how you created. In Buddhism, there is no first point. This is one of the places where Buddhism is very different from other teachings and religions. What is the purpose of life? Well, what do you think is the purpose of life? The purpose of life is what is it that you want in life? And what everybody wants is to find some kind of happiness, find some kind of contentment, overcome problems. Is that what you want? Or do you want more depression? Do you want more sadness? How many people would like more depression here? Nobody. Yeah, see, you understand already the meaning of life. The meaning of life is to find happiness, yeah? This is what we're all searching for. That is why we crave in the first place. We crave because we are searching for happiness in one way or another. We want to have more happiness. We want to avoid suffering. This is the whole point of the craving, is to move us in that direction. But the craving doesn't deliver. Because the craving doesn't deliver, we have to find another way of finding that happiness. And this is where the spiritual path comes in. But the meaning of life is found that right there inside of you. Ask yourself what it is that you really want. Ask yourself what everything in your life is pointing towards. And it's pointing towards satisfying that feeling that there's something is lacking. That's what craving is all about. Something is lacking inside of you, so you want something more. How can we fill in that lack? By practicing the spiritual path. That's the purpose of life. The Buddhist teaching gives you the answer to the meaning of life. Where do you go after you die? Depends how you live. Live well, you go to a good place. Live really well, you don't go to any place at all. And that is the highest happiness. Last question. This is the one that was out there. This is a whole essay, so it's a good thing that I left it to last. So, Ajahn, thank you for giving us the antidote for restraining anger and ill will under the five hindrances that ruins meditation and that. In view of time constraint, I would appreciate if you could explain how to counteract and antidote for doubt arising during meditation. In the Sanghārava Sutta, Samyutta Nikāya 46-55, the Buddha gives a beautiful similar to illustrate the arising, the mind obstructed by the five hindrances. In respect of doubt hindrance, the Buddha said, imagine a bowl of water, agitated, stirred up, muddled, put in a dark place. Could you please give us the antidote to purifying doubt? Okay, in another sutta, Venerable Anuruddha asked the Buddha, you taught us at BGF in March 2019, Venerable Sir, as we abide here diligent, ardent, and resolute, we perceive both light and vision of forms. Soon afterwards, the light and vision of form disappears, but we have not discovered the cause for that. You should discover the cause for that, etc., etc. While I was still on the light, was that I too experienced those things. Soon afterwards, the light and form disappeared. What is the cause and condition for that light? Then I considered thus, doubt arose in me. And because of the doubt, my concentration fell away. When my concentration fell away, the light and vision, etc. Okay. Ajahn, I have got a vision of very bright ball of light during my meditation. Okay, that's wonderful. How to handle it, my doubt, and how to handle my doubt and take it a step deeper. Okay, good. Okay, so I see where you're coming from. So, doubt in the suttas, or doubt as one of the five hindrances, is a very particular kind of doubt. It's not any kind of doubt. And what it refers to is precisely the sort of doubt that you are talking about here. You already have something very beautiful happening in your meditation, and you don't know what to do next. Yeah? In other words, what it means, the way the Buddha explains this, is that you don't know what truly are the wholesome states and the unwholesome states. What are the blameworthy state and the blameless states? What are the dark states and the bright states? Yeah? This is what you don't know. And because you don't know that, you are not clear where you should be heading in the future with this one. What is the next step? What is it that leads to more wholesome, less unwholesome? That is the problem here. And this is the same problem the Buddha had, would have had, not the Buddha, but before he was the Buddha, he would have not known how to proceed. He had doubt about what should be the next thing to do. So what you need to do is always just to ask yourself, from your experience, from what you read in the suttas, what is the most wholesome way of proceeding? How can I make this experience even more wholesome? And in general, the answer is very simple. If you already have a bright light in your mind, the things that you have got you there have been peace, yeah? So you have to continue that peace. The things that have got you there is not willpower, but allowing to let go of the willpower, not doing anything. When you get to this point, you have to do even less. You have to just enjoy what is happening and not to do anything at all about it. Sitting back, allowing things to be here. Being at the movie theater, seeing the most wonderful movie in your life, this wonderful, blissful ball of light in your mind, You probably never had an experience more blissful than that in your entire life. So enjoy that, but don't do anything with it. And as you do that, as you just stay with it, you focus on the simplicity. You don't focus on the complexity of the image. Just focus on the very simple light, not on the edges. Just focus straight onto it. Allow it to be. Don't do anything. Then it will develop all by itself. The same path that got you there is exactly the path you have to continue to take it deeper. Stillness, not doing anything, allowing things to be, enjoying what you already have. And then this becomes more still, more peaceful, more beautiful, more glad. And eventually you will go into a jhana experience. Okay, so that is all for tonight. And yeah. Okay, very good. So let's just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and Ajahn Brahm will be back again, of course, tomorrow morning, and we can continue tomorrow morning.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho